Hi, I'm Nigel Campbell, editor of Jazz in the Islands magazine, with another episode of Island Jazz Chat, a podcast featuring conversations with Caribbean jazz and pan jazz musicians based in the islands and the diaspora. Welcome to Island Jazz Chat. Today I have the pleasure of speaking to pan jazz musician Garvin Blake. Welcome, Garvin. How are you?
Yeah, thanks, Nigel. It's great having me on your podcast that I actually listen to a lot. So it's informative. So it's a pleasure to be part of this series.
Thank you very much for being part of it. We had a conversation. Of course, Garvin is in Trinidad right now at the annual carnival return, as it was. And I think I had to grab this opportunity to have a conversation with you because I think in addition to collecting the collecting the memories and the kind of information about our musicians, I think it's important to note that Garvin has been part of a group of musicians based in the States who are continuing the kind of drive of making pan jazz a thing. So we normally have this kind of chronological conversation about your career, right? Your recording career ideally and thing. And I know that you have produced two albums over a period of at least 15, 16 years. So let me understand in the beginning, how did you get into this music business, the kind of business of jazz on pan?
Well, jazz on pan came a little late in my music kind of career, if you want to call it a career. I was born in Belmont, and growing up, next to me had a local steel band called Stereovax. Mm-hmm. So pan was always in my surroundings. I would go over there as a little kid and I guess bang on the pans. Then I had a cousin, David Mondy, who joined North Stars, and he was kind of my mentor. So he showed me some tunes. So as a little kid, maybe 6, 7, you know, that's how I got into pan.
To pan.
Mm-hmm. Right. Then I migrated to New York when I was 9.
What year was that?
That was 1972.
Okay, in the 70s. Wow.
Right. And for the first 2 years, wasn't involved in pan, although I did get together with some American guys, and we had like a little band of little kids that we played. I don't know what we played, but I guess it would be R&B. We just kept rhythm and a bass line. But in 75, I joined a steel band, and for the next 75 until probably like 1995, so like a 20-year span. Mm-hmm. I was involved in pan. The jazz thing came towards the end, the early 90s. Mm-hmm. A friend, Nolly Moses,
yes,
he's a writer, he lives in Jamaica now, told me that this Trinidadian musician, Raph Robinson, was in New York, and he does this calypso jazz, and he wanted a pan player, and Nolly recommended me. So improvising is something I always kind of did. We call it coasting. And so it wasn't formally jazz. Mm-hmm. You know, a jazz musician would say that's not jazz, but the concept of improvisation was always something that I explored. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then Raph came, and that was my more formal introduction. Although nothing about Raph is totally formal, but that was my introduction into quote unquote calypso jazz, where I would be the sole pan player. So he went from being one of 90 players in New York at that time to a soul pan player playing a different repertoire and had the demands of improvising. So that's how I got into calypso jazz or pan jazz.
Raph Robinson, rest in peace. Yeah. Important musician, certainly in this thing that I consider Kaiso jazz, Clive Zander, Raph Robinson, and others in the 21st century. But that connection with Raph, I understand, started your recording career, if I understand it correct, in terms of his album, Branches.
Right. So I met Raph, I don't know, the early 90s, and we used to play probably a couple of times a month, either in Brooklyn or sometimes in in the city. Mm-hmm. And we always had some Kitchener songs. Raph is a Kitchenophile.
Yes.
You know, so okay. he always had Kitchener songs in the repertoire. Then he said that he's going to arrange this, not arrange, he's going to record this album, and he wanted me to come and play mm-hmm. a couple of songs on it. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, but he's going to record this thing in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Raph, how are we getting to Toronto? He said, well, a mutual friend, Keith Lee Green, mm-hmm. you know, has a car. So Raph, I guess, sweet talk Keith Lee Green into using his car. So the three of us loaded up in Keith's car, like a compact, maybe a subcompact car. I can't remember the thing, probably like a Corolla or something like that. Mm. And we drove from Brooklyn to Toronto in some really thick fog.
Wow.
You know,
12 hours, nobody.
12 hours, yeah. We stopped for gas and the restroom. That was the same stop. Mm. And jokes all the way. And then we got to Toronto and we went straight to the studio. It was Eddie Bullen,
like a Grenadian musician.
Brilliant musician.
Thunderdome Studios.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we went down there and recorded. I was tired and nervous. I was like, Raph, how am I going to do this thing? You know, so having the mics in front of me was different than playing live. So mm-hmm. I was kind of nervous. And then Raph kind of coaxed me in. Mm. You know, he said, we could have died. So you had to do this, you know.
Yeah,
if we didn't dead, you got to do this. So
you remember any specific solo on that album that stood out in your mind?
I didn't really improvise mm-hmm. on that album. Mm-hmm. I played some melodies, you know, I think probably the Pan Night and Day melody and Branches. Then Raph overdubbed it. Mm-hmm. So the Pan doesn't really play the melody by itself. Mm-hmm. He overdubbed it. I don't think it had much Pan improvisation there.
Okay.
So he laid that down. Then he layered it with mm-hmm. other instruments. He brought in flutes and different. So that was my first experience in a studio putting on a mic. Headphones and a mic and saying, oh, man, this is, you know, hearing yourself on playback. I said, I sound like crap.
You weren't happy with it?
But, you know, Raph, you know, he stuck with it. And he didn't erase all the tracks. So.
Yeah. Well, the album is there, Branches.
Yeah, the album is iconic, though.
Definitely iconic. And more so now after his passing.
Yeah.
And there's that thing about 93, 94 or something.
Yeah,
I remember that. I can't remember the specific year, but I do remember the album. And this is my story. You know, I had met Raph. I lived in the States for like late 90s into the early 2000s. And I had met Raph. I'd always heard his music, the actual song Branches. It's a piece of music that used to be a theme song for a radio program in Trinidad here, an AM radio program. And somebody clued me in, well, that's Raph Robertson playing Branches. And I said, wow, this brilliant piece of music. Finally meet him in Washington, D.C. And I said, oh my God, this is Raph Robertson. And we'll have these conversations. And Raph is the kind of person just call you, hey, what happened to Nigel? And just start a conversation. Mm-hmm. Right? And it may happen at 7 o'clock in the morning, but that's a whole other story. But critically for me, of course, in giving me a copy of the album Branches, he clued me into this beautiful album that I heard called Bella Road Blues in 1999. I think I probably got it in 2000. But that was your debut album, Bella Road Blues. If I remember clearly, I think you recorded at Basement Recording. That's in Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Tell me about the genesis of that project and how it came to be, because I think there's an important person who's part of the production team who worked with a Grammy-winning songwriter, Paul Simon, on his Graceland album. Tell me about that album, Bella Road Blues, please.
Yeah, so Bella Road Blues is kind of started with what I used to do with Raph. I was in Raph's group, and Raph was really instrumental playing with him, and equally, Raph exposed me to a lot of musicians, you know, some mainstream jazz musicians in the New York area. Mm-hmm. You know, so one of them was Gene Torres, was a bass player that I met through him, Conrad Adley, a bass player. Mm-hmm. But probably the most significant in my career was meeting a drummer, Damon Dwight. So I met Damon through Raph. Then Raph was in New York, then he went to D.C., and who knows where Raph ended up.
I met him in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Right. And as a matter of fact, I went down to D.C. Mm-hmm. when he was launching. I wouldn't say he was launching Branches, but he was doing like a release down there and played on that. Mm-hmm. So Damon was probably the first person outside of the Caribbean and the Pan community that said, mm-hmm. Garvin, you know, come hang with us. And he introduced me to other musicians. So these guys are now a couple of degrees separated from Raph.
Yes.
So through Damon, who played, who I actually saw before I, Raf introduced me to him. Mm-hmm. He played with Hugh Masekela. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 90s. And my wife and I, Phoebe, were Hugh Masekela fans. So wherever Hugh Masekela played, we went SOBs, Jersey, and they had a killer band. So the Damon was one of the keys in the band on drums. Mm-hmm. They had a bass player called Bakiti Kumalo from South Africa. And they had this red man, Tony Cedrus, who was just like a natural musician. And so I played a couple of times with Damon. I was like, Damon, I want to record some stuff. You know, Raf is no wrong. Who I could do? I was like, who you could get? He said, well, I'll call Tony Cedrus. I was like, Tony Cedrus? So he called Tony Cedrus. Tony came. We hadn't played any gigs.
Yeah.
But he, I don't know, the South African vibe and the pan, Tony just felt right at home with this. So with Tony, Tony then called in other musicians. So like Ciro Batista, who's considered a Brazilian world-class percussionist. Aaron Hike, who's ended up on the Tonight Show band. And Tony became the co-producer. And I had no idea I was doing it. I knew I wanted to play a couple of Kitchener songs. And I had written Pan Romance for a Panorama competition in New York in, when was that? 1991.
Yes.
So I said, I want to record this. And I reached out to Robin. I was like, I wonder if I could get David Rudder to...
Robin Foster,
who is a childhood friend, like god brother, family go back generation. I was like, can you get David Rudder? So I was brave. He's like, yeah, I'll call David. And it so happened David was in Brooklyn at the time.
Yes.
And Brooklyn, he was staying on New York Avenue in Midwood. So that would be, that would be Flatbush going into Crown Heights. And I called up David. He said, sure, because David and I had a connection too, because his grandmother, Miss Samuels, lived on St. Bob's. And as a child, I would see David going up there religiously. So I called David, and he was gracious. He listened to the music. He took the lyrics and he tweaked them, and he came in the studio and laid down Pan Romance.
Sweet Pan, the voice of an island in the Caribbean Sea. She is the child, that triumphant child, born from the womb of poverty. Now anytime I hear you pan, my spirit moves me head and hand. Something about your vibration turns me to a magic man. A spirit comes and just controls me. I know that this is where I have to be. The love, the joy, peace and serenity.
So Tony Cedrus was key because he was bringing in the other musicians. Like Rudder, I reached out to get David Rudder, but he was bringing in musicians. And so he was it. And then we played together after that for years. So I said, and he passed away
maybe
a month ago. Yeah. He's a singular musician because I met him as playing accordion. He played accordion with Paul Simon.
With Paul Simon and the Graceland album. That's right. Yeah. The name, when I remember... Again, Ralph Robertson, at the time in D.C., that's where I met him. He said, oh, you have to check out this album. There's a partner of mine, Gavin Blake. I'd never heard of you.
Yeah.
I said, okay, well, there's Gavin Blake. When I saw Tony Cedrus, because I read it. I'm the nerd that reads
liner
notes. So I saw it. I said, that fella played with Paul Simon and Graceland.
Yeah.
And I put it on in the first track, had this kind of feel.
Yeah, definitely.
I said, wait now, who is this guy?
Yeah, Tony's a singular musician, you know. he would play calypso, but whatever he does, he puts Tony Cedra's stamp on it.
Yeah,
you know. So I was really fortunate, you know, to have met Raf, and then Tony Cedra became good friends. As a matter of fact, he wanted to get me over to South Africa because he had moved back.
Yes,
but that never happened.
That'd have been interesting because I'm thinking there's a slight South African connection. Andy Narell, who I'm sure everybody knows, goes to South Africa, and he had worked with a producer who had said there's an audience for Pan in South Africa. Andy had done a concert, Arts Alive, 60,000 people.
Wow.
And they all know Andy's, and they're basically singing the melodies of Andy's songs. But I think they also, the marimba is a very important instrument in their music industry. And it has a very similar quality,
right,
not necessarily tone, but certainly a certain quality. So there's a understanding of if you play a pan, if you play a marimba, they can be almost in the same family.
And the music is similar to Trinidad Calypso in the sense it's very rhythmic.
Very much so.
And, you know, the baseline South African music isn't necessarily harmonically the most complex, although the guys would take it and
do magic,
but the foundation is like calypso jazz. The foundation may not necessarily be stretching harmonies to its outer bounds, but then they would take this, I would call it elemental material, and when they're finished with it, Tony and them finished with it, it's, you know, it's mind-boggling what they could do with three chords.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, that album opened my eyes to you, and it also put on notice that there's a possibilities for pan jazz outside of what had happened, certainly in terms of the existing pan jazz, Rudy Smith and these others who had played the bebop or the kind of West Indian rhythms, as I would call it, like that, right? Here was somebody venturing into the South African lane and finding a space where the pan could fit almost seamlessly into it, right? So that album, as I said, opened my eyes to your possibilities and that kind of stuff. And I've been following your hope, following that track and looking out for the next album.
Right.
Looking out for the next album. As I said, Bella Road Blues came out in 1999. But the second album came out in 2015. Yeah. So there was a gap. So tell me, I know, as I said, I think I understand the music industry was not necessarily your primary source of income. You basically lived a life and had a job, as it was. Is that correct?
Yeah, so music is something I always did. Mm-hmm. On the side, sometimes more seriously than others. I shouldn't say serious because anytime I'm playing, I'm serious, but I didn't always invest that much time into it. So after Bella Road Blues, what happened? I was kind of get caught up in job stuff, and my daughter was born in 1993. So she was like all 7, 8, which is, I couldn't really invest that time for a music career. And I had done the arithmetic a long time ago. This is not financially sustainable for me. So it's not that I ever wanted to be a musician. Music has always been something I did.
Yes.
So we did, in that interim, we after Bella Road Blues, we started playing pretty regularly at this place called Sugarcane Restaurant, which is my sister-in-law's restaurant on Flatbush.
Okay.
Tony Cedrus was initially part of that. You know, group, Damon DeWitt, who else, Gene Torres, those same guys that I met. And during that period, this guy, Ralph Ramsey, came up with an idea to do a Father's Day, quote-unquote, pan jazz in Lincoln Center.
I think I remember seeing that.
Right. So right in that window, Tony wasn't available anymore. And Frankie McIntosh became the main keyboard player. So just imagine that's the sub.
Yeah.
You know, so
Frankie McIntosh, Vincent Jansen. Right. And
if I back up, Frankie was also involved in Bella Road Blues.
He was?
After we did the first few songs, Tony and I agreed that maybe we should get a different feel. And the Pan Romance arrangement is Frankie McIntosh. And then we did A minor with Frankie. So Frankie became part of what I consider my family of musicians that I would play with and reach out to. But as we started doing this gig on Flatbush, we used to do it like almost every week, then it changed. Tony couldn't do it because of time, and then Frankie started doing it. And we developed, like, I wouldn't say a big following, but people who liked what we were doing because we were playing some Kitchener, some Spiral. But harmonically, it was stretching out a little bit more than some of the other things that people were doing. Then Ramsey was aware of Bella Road Blues. So he was like, okay, you did Bella Road Blues. That was a good marketing thing for him because he wanted someone that had an album, not just someone who played well. Not that I played that well, but he wanted, you know, to say, well, this guy has a product. And so he mentioned that. And based on that, we started tweaking the repertoire.
Yes.
Is this balancing act, especially when you're going playing for a Caribbean audience, is, although a lot of the Caribbean audience, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, use the term jazz. But if you go, I don't know what was the right phrase, but if you go too deep,
if you go into too the out stuff, there,
too out there, and if there's themes that they're not familiar with, like melodies they're not familiar with, or rhythms they're not familiar with, you could lose them.
Yes.
And it's no dig against the audience. This is not what they normally listen to.
I understand, and I hear that, because any audience, you know, the familiarity is what they look for, right? So, and that familiarity comes with hearing it often. I'm assuming that this music that you were playing wasn't being played on the radio that frequently and that kind of stuff.
No.
So it's only what they know is what they know. So if you do an arrangement of Kitchener or Green, whatever, rather, oh, we know that.
Right.
Right. And if you go too far out, as you said, you got to say, hey, hey.
Yeah, the fellas doing, yeah. So so what we did, Frankie was in the group, so he came up with some arrangements of, I decided that, you know, we're going to meet this audience on the half, but still try to play music with integrity. So we ended up we kind of was still at the Sugarcane thing, tweaking the repertoire. Frankie did an arrangement of Pan and Harmony.
Yes.
In a way, changed it into like a waltz and extended the harmonies in strange places. Then we what else we did Fancy Sailor we played with not much adornment. Because from Raf's,
Clive Zander's Fancy Sailor.
Yeah, Clive Zander's Fancy Sailor. That was always a part of what we did from Raf, roughly. Yeah,
that's a standard now in the Kaito Jazz repertoire.
Yeah, and then we did, what did we did? Every Time I Pass, we did that. You know, the folk song, we didn't really do much with it. We just kept it in the folk tradition. But I always consider that song, I always look for the link between the blues and calypso. And that song is probably as close that I could think that it has a blues type of form. It's in a minor. So we played that, and then we did Afraid. You know, Sparrow's Afraid. That was rearranged. And then we did Caravan, which I had recorded. And what was the other song we did? That might have been it. We did four or five songs. But then that went over really well. You know, on that bill, it was a really nice cast because Andy Norell was there. Who else was on it?
Was Happy Williams there?
No, Happy didn't play. Andy had his own group. I think he had Darius Eskenazi. So he had his local New York,
his New York,
you know,
group,
top guys. And what's his name had a group. Liam Teague was on that gig too. And it went over well, and people after that, I was like, boy, when we go hear Afraid again. And so that was the genesis of Parallel Overtones. It was really recording stuff we had played, you know, as opposed to, I could have discarded it too and moved on to something else, but people wanted to hear it. So that was, then we came up with a couple of new tunes. Frankie wrote a song for Bugsy, but that was the genesis of Parallel Overtones.
That came out in 2015.
Yeah.
And, well, that's his second album, and there's a third one I'm hoping coming up before the world ends, as it was. But I'm happy that you've kind of linked some musicians there. Of course, Raf Robinson being the first one, Damon DeWhite, Tony Cedras, Frankie McIntosh. So that kind of group of musicians you have here helping you to create music, I think, is an important group. Because as you rightly said, it was not your day job, the pan and music, and then you had a job, you had a child and family and that kind of stuff, right? The arithmetic was not enough. But you still had an important contribution to make. And of course, with the assistance of these musicians, I think that was important. And the two albums, I think, are important in the kind of canon of pan jazz music. I mean, there are a number of musicians who may have more than two records and things, but it's important to note what you have added to the whole conversation about this thing called pan jazz. Happy that you're doing this, and I'm happy that you're continuing. What are your plans though for the future? Because as much as everybody likes to talk about what happened in the past, what is your vision for, I'm assuming that you retired from your job?
Yeah, I'm retired before the pandemic. I mean,
before the pandemic?
Yeah, one of the plans was to get deeper into music, and the pandemic kind of put a halt on life.
Mm-hmm. You know, everybody.
And everyone. Oh. But my plans is to keep playing, you know, seek out more gigs.
Because I've seen that you and Frankie do gigs regularly.
Yeah. And when I go back, we have a few gigs. As a matter of fact, this morning, one of the club owners said, man, so I want to continue doing that. But I definitely want to record. And it's always in the back of my mind to write music. Like the first album.
I was going
to
ask you about composition.
Right. The first album, I was either brave or naive. So I had written Pan Romance, and I was brave, and David Rudder recorded, and I wrote Bella Road Blues. You know, Bella Road Blues is basically a calypso blues, but I was listening to Randy Weston, who has Caribbean roots. He had some, I was into that album, and he had like a blues with a calypso rhythm. So I said, oh, let me write one of these. But what happened to me with it, in composing, the more I play what I consider the American Songbook and some of the compositions by the Wayne Shorters and the Monks, and the less confident I get in what I could produce as a composer. So is that kind of thing. Do I go and write something that I'm not satisfied with or play great songs that just, it's just a launching pad for my improvisation. So to me, what I do primarily is I'm an improviser more than a composer.
Yes.
But I would like to probably attempt some compositions again.
Well, so, I mean, one of the things that has happened, certainly in terms of our Trinidad pan scene, there was a time when, of course, for Panorama, our biggest competition here among ensemble band bands, they played calypsos, and Kitchener, of course, being a harmonic genius in calypso, his music dominated. But then, of course, we all know Len Bugsy Sharp and Ray Holman, they said, well, we're going to write our own songs. And there was a period, I remember, I want to say the 90s, where every pan arranger was writing their own song, right? Some were good, some were just not good. Let's not pretend they were all magic, right? But the idea of composition, certainly by musicians, is something that I hold daily, because I've always said, part and parcel of what our kind of cultural moorings is and our kind of legacy is that we have to, one, record our music, but we have to record our own music, right? Rearranging all the music of Duke Ellington is all well and good. But arranging and rearranging the music of Ralph Robertson, of Kitchener, Sparrow, whomever, I think is a lot more important. So on the first album, you wrote two songs, Pan Romance and Bella Road Blues.
Right.
What about the second album?
I didn't write any songs.
No,
it was more or less what we played at that concert. And Frankie wrote an original one for Bugsy. So I didn't write
anything.
No, probably should have.
Do you have songs written in your catalog?
Not recently. I had songs. Actually, as I said, I used to write more songs when I was in the pan world. You know, so I was coming out of this. I'm probably the generation, two generations after Ray Holman and a generation after Bugsy. So when I was coming up in pan, I was going to write. So my first Panorama attempt in New York was audacious. It's like, I'm going to be the Ray Holman, not in terms of music, but I'm going to write my own song.
Yes, that's a goal.
And I did write my own song, but then they dropped the sixth, and then I was like, I don't know. Then I switched from that, and I did more conventional songs. And with that, I was much more, I don't know if musically successful, but in terms of the placing, all of a sudden I was coming second, third, second. So I did that for like, but when I got into jazz, I kind of was busy trying to navigate this new musical terrain, and composing wasn't what I focused on. But I think it's something that when I record again, which I hope to do start this year, I'm going to write some pieces, whether they're good or bad, I'm going to write them.
The public will let you know.
So I think it's important to write your own music. But as I said, with jazz, to me, at the highest level, I'm not at that level, but at the highest level, you're composing.
You're composing, yeah.
You're composing. You know, you could play a theme, abandon the theme, which is kind of abandon the harmony to a certain degree, and in the spur of the moment, you're composing.
You're composing, you're improvising, you're extemporizing as Gleison.
Right, so short answer is like, I plan to write some songs.
I would, as I said, I'm only just a listener, and I always encourage any musician, record, compose, record your compositions, right? Because I think it's important, as I said, to build a catalog of original music, right? We've done, calypsonians have done that for more than a century, right? Our musicians, yes, we do arrangements and that kind of stuff. I don't know how many of them score their arrangements, so if they can be reproduced.
I mean, steel pan
arrangements, right? That's something
I think some do, I believe.
Some do, yes. But as a conversation, that's been ongoing for many years in terms of scoring the music and things. But I think the next level, or the next step, because I remember having this conversation with Raf again. Raf had said that Panorama music is the last bastion of Western classical music. This was his statement at the time.
Oh, okay.
the way he saw that, and he thought it was so important that musicians, pan musicians, arrangers, and even soloists such as yourself, document your work, but more importantly, compose work to add to that canon, because it's just not enough, but it's unique, right? I don't know how you feel about it, if you think that pan music is a unique music, or is it just a continuation of what soloists do on any instrument?
It's unique, definitely. So I would consider the arrangers, you know, certainly the top arrangers, they're composers. Because when you're given, I don't know, some of these songs vary, but we'll just say, you're given 32 bars of music, which may last a minute or so, roughly. And then you extend this thing for another 7, back in the day, it used to be 10 minutes. You're composing. So to a certain degree, it's similar to what some European composers did, like Béla Bartók and them. They would go and hear folk music and take folk melodies and then extend it. But no one is saying that Béla Bartók is playing somebody else's music.
Yeah.
When he's finished with it, you know, it's recognizable, but it's been transformed into something else. And to touch on the pan world, the challenge with steel band arranging is, it's the beauty in it is that it has wide appeal.
Yes.
You know, so it have people like yourself who are probably well listened and have certain expectations or certain things you would like. And then it's have a lot of people who just don't push them too far. They want to hear what they want. So as a panorama arranger, you're kind of boxed in. Then you have judges who I really don't know them, just their names.
Yeah, they,
from the sense I get with them, not that anything is wrong with what they're doing, they tend to be conservative. So if you start pushing too far, you know, it's like you could lose your job.
Yeah.
You know, you could end up eighth and be out of a job. But pan is a steel band music, I agree with Raph, it's unique in a lot of ways. I mean, sonically, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And it's unique in the sense that, at least in the Caribbean, it's the last, it's the only true orchestral music that we hear.
Yes.
You know, people just don't listen to 8 minutes of music without vocals.
It's true. The instrumental music is hard to sell.
The fact that Trinidad and its spread, you know, to
all parts of the world, Japan, South Africa,
that you could get someone who doesn't listen to instrumental music, maybe ever, but they listen to Panorama, and a lot of them have informed opinions. I may not agree, but so Panorama has served, it identifies a culture and also served as music appreciation. Some people, they didn't go to music school, but they could tell you, nah, that changed key, right? That rhythm. So is this really unique? Because classical music, maybe in the early days, it appealed to the common folks, but now classical music is kind of an elitist thing. You know, the people who go to classical concerts in New York.
Yes.
Demographically and socially tend to be similar. Panorama,
everybody
is there.
Everybody,
so my wife was saying Panorama, and maybe I might write the piece, Panorama is the true all-inclusive. You know,
I like that phrase. The Panorama is the true all-inclusive.
The other all-inclusives are really the all-exclusives. The excluding people. And I think you had mentioned it, that they're roping people out. Because I'm watching this, I'm like, so you're herding some people in.
Well, and it is a phenomenon that happened some time ago in terms of, there was a kind of security measure they claimed. But watching it this year, I mean, they were just a mass of people. Nobody was in a costume. Admittedly, it was late on a Tuesday afternoon. But the rope was still there. And these people had to do this thing. And music, and the music that they listened to, of course, well, you know the song they say it was DNA, whatever it is. But it was just like a herd of people going down the road. And I've just wondered if they're following this pathway. Was the music moving them? Was it what guided them? Because with pan, there was no pan on the road. Carnival Tuesday. Well, where I was at up to a certain point, they may have had pan late in the evening.
Yeah, Exodus and All Stars.
Yeah, late in the evening, they had kind of stuff and thing. But the idea of music being a kind of mover of people, a pan music that is one of those things that is. I wouldn't say it's slowly slipping away. Panorama still has its crowd and that kind of stuff. But the audiences are not as large and as not as determined, as, to me, as I've seen before. And I'm wondering if there's a role for arrangers or composers or even soloists, because we do know that the ensemble, we call them ensemble, I call it a pan, a steel band,
right?
But for the non-listener, an ensemble of steel pans. And then there's the soloists with conventional instruments, right, as we know them, right? And I think that the thing that could take us forward is the soloist. This is just my thinking, right? Because we have enough on the ground in terms of recording. They have many recordings of steel bands,
right,
going all the way back to, I think, the 40s or the 50s or something like that. But in terms of soloists, I think from the 70s, I think just before we came on here, we spoke about Rudy Smith out in Sweden making a record, Otinku, and then Will Rodney making a record, right, in New York, 1972, I think it was, Friends and Countrymen. And then since then, a lot of soloists have had where the soloist is there, and you're part of that, right, grouping of thing of musicians. But I've always thought, I don't know why, possibly because of the kind of dominance of one pan man, we're not going to call his name for a third and fourth time, but you know what I'm talking about, with 18 albums, that the solo album has a place in the group of music from this part of the world that can do something for us. I don't know what you think about the idea that pan jazz can be quote-unquote global music. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I think it is. It definitely could be. And, in fits and starts, you're seeing it, because I think the interesting thing about pan and jazz, they kind of have the same history. You know, it's Africans in the Western Hemisphere reacting to oppression. It started at the margins, and now it's kind of become academic to a certain degree.
Yes.
But I think pan, the sonority of a pan blended with other instruments has the potential for wider appeal than 100 people playing pans. You know, the spirit of a steel band, I know the right way, it kind of happens in the moment. So in the moment, there's probably nothing more visceral and more impactful than hearing a Desperados or All Stars at full throttle, because I've been to a lot of jazz festivals. I'll be biased, but they hit me in a certain way, but they don't hit you like a steel band. You know, so but that has its place.
That's true.
But I think the improviser blended with other instruments, I think that has a far reach. And I would think a lot of the youths in Trinidad, you know, Trinidad is never shortage of talent. It's just the direction that the youths decide to go. It seems like Panorama is kind of what the talented players do now. You have some soloists. But it's, and it could be that Trinidad don't have the market for a guy to play four times a week in a club. But I think
it
definitely has a reach if it's done well. Because I think the sonority is beautiful. You know, and it's this other voice that a lot of people still haven't heard.
Damn it. Hood, yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, so jazz is always looking, as Herbie said, jazz is democratic, so it's always looking for this other voice to give another voice a chance to spread the gospel. So
that's why it's important for people like you, Gavin Blake, to add to the canon so that Herbie could hear these other voices, right? As it stands, we have a lot of American musicians who are putting out multiple albums. Victor Provost, Andy Norell, obviously, his brother Jeff, Jonathan Scales, and others, right? But in terms of Trinidadians who are producing pan jazz, right? I'm drawing a blank at the second. Of course, Gavin Blake, but I'm sure you're going to help me out, and people are going to help big stones at me because they know all the names.
Yeah, I guess Foster.
Leon Foster Thomas.
Foster's doing some stuff.
I know.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, some young
guys that Kareem Thompson. So yeah.
I think Sean Tweet had an album or two.
Right. So they're making
Kareem the Dream. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, what I look forward to, and not for me because it's not something I did full time, but I'm looking for like an Etienne Charles type pan player. Not doing exactly what Etienne's doing, but having that type of impact that he has.
Why can't it be you?
It could, you know. If I want to dedicate, but I'm also looking at it. I mean, I could play a role, you know, certainly but I'm looking at a generation
below you,
below me, to really push it. I mean, I could do it. I mean, to a certain degree, I could get probably complacent, you know. That's it. The downside in having a job. So it's like, do I really need to be reaching out to all these people? So so I like the music aspect of pan, but I'm not always kind of eager for the commerce aspect, which is crucial.
I'm not saying it's a business deal. We still do nothing
called
music.
So that business thing, I'm like, you know what, I could watch the Knicks and so which is, you know, I raised my hand, but
you're really an American.
I could probably play continue to play whatever role that I'm playing. So we probably don't need one person. We probably need a school of people, because art forms don't move singularity. It's normally it's a group of people.
Yes, correct.
So you can't say like, I want to hear this person. It's like, oh, I want to hear this one, that one. And I think that could happen if a lot of the younger musicians, and Trinidad certainly have talent, and that they get together with other really good musicians. I mean, one of the best advice I ever got from Rudy Smith is like, "Boy, make sure he's the shit on in the band." So I would encourage the youths to find
better musicians
or more experience. Yeah. You know, I don't want to use the better words, but more experienced musicians. Search them out, play with them if you can, pick their brain, and looking inward in that little circle, it helps you, but it helps you in that circle. When you move out of that circle, unless you're super talented, you could be into some, like when Clive Zander was alive, I know Ray Holman is alive, they should be banging down these guys' doors.
Yes.
Now, Ray Holman should have a line from the Oval to his house.
With
people asking Ray, tell me anything. You know, go with it. But I've gotten to meet Ray over the last couple of years. I don't sense that's what's happening. I'm not sense that anyone was going to Earl other than maybe a Jason Batiste. And I wouldn't want to paint with a broad
Jason, Batiste and Earl were a unit almost, right?
Those you should really reach out to the senior people and pick their brains.
You're quite correct. I mean, I hear what you're saying. It reflects, I just have to quote this because it just popped in my head. Pat Metheny always said, always top world class, probably the best guitarist in the business and that kind of stuff. He said he was always told, when you go on the bandstand, be the worst musician on the bandstand.
Right.
Because that's the only you get better. You have to go with better musicians. Right. And what you're saying is correct. I mean, we have icons that you just call them, Rodney, Clive Zander, Ray Holman, Bugsy Sharp. And people supposed to be going and being mentees to those gentlemen, as to be mentors and that kind of stuff. I do not know what's the reason why it's not done more frequently or at all, I should say. There may be other reasons, like I don't know the relationship between those icons and followers. I don't know if there's a kind of a hole on a second.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if it's the case that people are just indifferent, younger musicians are indifferent, and they want to just chart their own course as if the past didn't exist. Because there's something that happens in Trinidad music where we kind of forget that there were pioneers who came before us, which is unfortunate, right? And so that, you know, young Calypsonian soca artist will tell you that, who's Sparrow? Right. So that is a told Sparrow that word Sparrow. Right. And Sparrow say, okay, I'm coming back. And Sparrow came back and won a road branch. To prove to everybody, no, this is who I am, right? Marshall did it this year with Calypso Monarch in terms of like, everybody said, Marshall casting Calypso. Eh? We saw what happened. But that aside, I think we are in a space here where you are a part of, as you said, you are two generations below Ray Holman.
Right.
But I think you're above the generation of Andre White or even a Jonathan Scales or, or Kareem the Dream and that kind of stuff. But you're part of, I think, a generation that can be adding to the canon. Right? This is me, Nigel Campbell, asking you, Gavin Blake, put some more recordings on.
I'm going to definitely. Now you energize me. That was definitely the plan to start this year. So I need to come up with a concept of what I want to do. I mean, what I plan to do this year, but I don't know if I'll record it commercially, is do a concert probably in the fall, because I have some gigs in the summer that might get in the way of Sparrow and Kitchener's music in a concert, but probably picking some lesser known songs. I mean, we'll play the Pan and Harmonies, but we might pull a Mrs. Harriman, some to show the breath.
The range and the breath.
Right. Mm-hmm. But as I said, I need to probably write some music and probably tweak the instrumentation, because I've been playing essentially in a quartet setting, so I might look to explore.
You play a tenor or double second?
Double second.
Yeah. Like all the great ones.
The tenor versus double second will get me in trouble. But
you have an opinion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a double second player. I think, and tenors, they're getting extended ranges now. So one of the things is
Halfers, provost, they play these big tenors.
Right. So they have a certain range. So I think, you know, in general, the double second affords a wider range. And even if the tenor range is extended, in my ears, it doesn't have the sonority of a double second. And here's another thing that I observed. I used to play tenor way back. I could probably still fumble on it. And this is not specific to the top tenor players. I think it's could be problematic to an upcoming tenor player, you know. So Tony Williams, you know, one of the true geniuses to come through the country and came out with this layout, the cycle of the cycle of fourths and fifth, which made the tenor pan easier to play. The downside of that is a lot of, I don't know if it's the right word, some of the lazier tenor pan players, they start now playing on reflexes, because you could just do certain things and sound reasonable. The double second doesn't have this reasonableness built into it, so it's more difficult to play in general. But it, at least for me, it forces you to make some musical choices. The tenor, for a weaker player, you could get away with just going and just up and down the scale, which
a million notes in a second.
and your prowess or your prowess or your artistry is measured like an Olympian.
Yes.
It's not necessarily measured to me as a, it's like, how many notes can you fit in 5 seconds? And we if have you some don't fit like this that, amount of notes, it doesn't work. So the double second, at least for me, it has some symmetries, but it forces you to make some choices. And I think just the range of it is just wider. I say, but half is in them.
Halfers, Victor Provost, I know they play these large, expanded tenor pans, right?
Yeah.
But that's just Narelle, of course, Boogsy,
Rodney. Yeah, it's more challenging, but I think for me, it's more rewarding. Like, I could probably go back and play a tenor, but I would never do it, you know? But nothing against tenor players. Yeah. Guys, I love you.
don't write angry letters.
Yeah, don't write angry letters. And I think the double second is more rewarding, maybe as we the tuning change. But I know when they extend the range, it doesn't have the sonority in the low end that a double second has, because the metal is stretched.
Have you ever played a G pan?
No.
Okay.
No, I've never.
I'll cut that off.
You have an opinion? I haven't played one, so I don't have an opinion.
Okay, but I'll cut that out.
Yeah. I mean, my take on, for me personally, is the double second I play comes from F sharp. You know, people go down to E. At this point in my career, I need my notes to stay where they are.
Okay.
So I don't have to worry about proving to anybody I could play any pan. I want to be able to make the most music I could make, and I think I'm more effective playing an instrument that I've played for the last 40 years. But the G-Pan probably has merit, but I haven't played one to make it, and I wouldn't switch.
I hear you. Well, with that said, kind of going to wrap up the conversation now, but because I think you have said at this point in your life, you want to make sure the notes are where they are. And I would suggest, because where the notes are, you can then do some composition and recording. I go, this is my mantra for the whole conversation. Eh? More recorded, more composition.
Yeah, so that's definitely I appreciate the conversation and the encouragement. But yeah, you said we...
What do you said your plan to record? I know you said some gigs in summer, and you probably have this project with some alternate Sparrow and Kitchener music and thing. But when do you really plan to do any recording once again?
Probably towards the end of the year. What I need to do this year is start building the repertoire. Because what I realized, the best way, at least for me to record, is to have some tunes, play them in public, get feedback, get comfortable with it, as opposed to writing the songs, giving somebody a chat. You know, so it's probably going to start when I go back, at least fleshing out
some new songs. You're going to be working with Frankie McIntosh, or you have other musicians to work with?
Well, Frankie's definitely going to be part of it, you know. So I have like some core musicians that's been playing with me for a long time. Calvin Jones, he's been on the road. He's, you know, a bass player. Now we've been using a Guyanese, Max Govia. So I'll bring in that, but I'll probably bring, kind of like Belarus Blues, bringing other musicians.
Do you plan to work with musicians outside of the Caribbean, like how you did with Cedras?
Yeah, I mean, most of the musicians, other than Frankie and now Max, because Calvin has been on the road, has been outside the Caribbean. So I know you mentioned a lot about the calypso jazz and the canon, and I mean, I've fallen to, I don't know, in my mind, a kind of strange space. Because I've been in the United States so long, an American musician, I'm just as home with them socially, maybe to a certain degree, more than a Trinidadian musician. Yeah. So bringing in, you know, playing with the Calvin Jones, Damon DeWise, the Tony Cedras, that's natural to me. That's kind of...
That you're an American, in a sense. You're born in Trinidad, effectively.
I like people who bring... their own voice to this thing.
What I was thinking, though, is that Cedras brought his South African thing to your first album. I'm just wondering if there's another culture, let's use that phrase then, that is like another South African, somebody in Malaysia or somebody in Spain or something. So that could intensify to discover a different route.
Yeah, to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tony, I mean, I say he's so unique. You could get a South African musician that would hear what we're doing, and some of his South Africanness may be lost. Tony's one; he's a Thelonious Monk, whatever. I remember playing Happy Birthday with Tony, and it sounds the same way if he's playing a township thing. He's also the kind of guy that he puts like a singular stamp. I mean, he put a stamp on Paul Simon.
Yes.
So finding someone. Even if I found someone that had a different culture, I would have to probably tell them, which I don't really like to tell people what to do, that bring out your you-ness. Tony didn't have to tell him that. This is, he a fancy sailor. This is how he's hearing it.
Okay.
You know, he doesn't hear it like Clive Zander would hear it. You know, I mean, Frankie doesn't hear it that
they
way
either.
Me
either. Yeah.
You know, Frankie's unique in the sense that of all the musicians that I've been around, he's probably the... I don't like to rank people, but in terms of versatility, I mean, he could do the hardcore soca, road mad stuff.
Yeah.
He could play
the music for Baron.
Right. And he could play the most abstract jazz pieces too.
And I've seen him do it too.
You know, and then he could also play classical music. And it's still Frankie. So I don't ever say, well, you do this, you do that. Like a drummer who plays with us a lot now when Damon isn't playing, Chris Edelton. I mean, Chris plays a soca, you would think he's from Mova somewhere. So it's like, play what you're playing and bring it. But I see what you're saying, like a singular person who refuses it and take it somewhere.
Yeah, there was clearly a difference between the Cedras songs on that first album, and admittedly, Pan in A Minor and Pan Romance.
Right.
But definitely parallel overtones. which Frankie kind of dominated in terms of the production and performance. And I was just, I was very keen when I heard the Cedra South African vibe. I said, oh, this is a different direction because I've never heard that in a pan.
Right.
I'm just wondering if that's something you want to continue down.
Yeah, I definitely want to keep searching.
Or you just want to keep searching for something brand new every single time.
Yeah, I mean, I want to keep improving as an improviser. That's my foremost thing to improvise in a better way where I could draw on all my influences, kind of like code switch.
Yes.
You know? So like part of me rooted in Belmont, part of me is rooted in Brooklyn. And so that, as a musician, I want to bring that where Charlie Parker and John Buddy Williams could coexist in the same solo.
Boom. They have it.
You know, so that, but that's on me to try to do that. But I'm going to bring in other musicians from other disciplines, especially percussionists. I think a percussionist, regardless of what you're playing, can color music too.
Yeah.
Just with, you know, they hear rhythms differently. So we'll see. And I know you'll keep me honest.
Yes. And the future looks bright here for Gavin Blake.
Yeah.
Yes, Ciro Batista. I'm just thinking, as you said, percussionist, you also had some other musicians from Latin
Kofu
culture. And
Kofu's a Nigerian.
Yeah, the African. It's going to be grand. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been a fabulous conversation with Gavin Blake. Two albums, Bella Road Blues and Parallel Overtones, but more music to come. He has never stopped, but he's retired from his day job. So he now has more time to create and to relate and to work with, I should say, his fellow musicians up in the States and things. Gavin, thank you very much for this conversation. I hope we continue talking again, and I'll review your next record when it comes out.
Thanks a lot, Nigel.
All the best.
Continue success with the podcast and promoting the culture.
Thank you very much. Island Jazz Chat has been a production of Jazz in the Islands magazine, powered by iRadio.tt.